thing you mentioned. And another thing you mentioned was that Mother said the first thing to do is to change the constitution. So I would like you to tell me if you remember certain important things like that, because they are not noted anywhere. And they are important.
In 1970, permit me to speak in English.
Please, certainly.
In 1970, Mother told me that for India, 24 hours out of 24 hours every day. And this inspired me to make a study of India. And along with some other colleagues, we discussed several problems of India. And then, at a certain time, I had the privilege of putting some questions to my mother. And she very kindly answered these questions. As I told you, at one time she told me that she wanted to bring a large number of women in the parliament. She even said that we should organize all over the country centers of women.
Mm-hmm.
She even gave the name
mm-hmm.
and said they should be called Shakti centers. She had also told me that we should all read Sri Aurobindo, because Sri Aurobindo had given solutions to all the problems. But to find these solutions, we have to read Sri Aurobindo both extensively and intensively. And this had also inspired me to read once again, many books of Sri Aurobindo, which I did earlier, but now in the new light and with new inspiration, I began to read them. I read particularly the Foundations of Indian Culture, the Ideal of Humanity, the Human Psycho, Essays on the Gita, and the Life Divine. In the Life Divine, I had come across one very important sentence which had struck me very much. And based upon that sentence, I made a statement to the mother that we should create in the country a number of communes. Small Oroville's all over the country. And it should have basic principle which Sri Aurobindo had stated in the Life Divine,
yes,
of which I spoke to you earlier. And that statement was, I'm not able to quote exactly word by word,
yes,
but I will tell you the basic meaning of that sentence. Man should not live for himself, nor for his family, nor for the group, nor for the society, nor for the country, nor for humanity, but for the divine and divine alone. I added that in addition to this basic proposition, we should have in each commune collective property so that nobody claims any property as his own. And that everyone should be given the facilities to grow towards self-perfection. And society must serve the individual, and the individual should serve the society for their mutual perfection. And when I said this, Mother was so pleased, and she said, excellent, excellent, excellent. And she said so enthusiastically that Champaplalji, who was just near the mother, standing near her, he said, Kirij, make thousands of copies of this statement and distribute all over. So this was a very inspiring moment in my life. At one stage, Mother told me that I should bring together all that Sri Aurobindo has said on materialism. This was in the context of a statement I made to the mother, that I felt that the youths of India need our urgent attention. And she said, yes, it is extremely important. And then I said that I would like to make a compilation from the writings of Sri Aurobindo on this subject. So she said that I should go to her every evening and read out to her my compilation. And in that context, she said that I should first begin with what Sri Aurobindo has said about materialism. Then I prepared my compilation on this subject and read out to her. And she listened to my compilation very, very attentively and suggested even the placement of paragraphs so that everything reads logically. And in regard to a few statements, when I had a doubt whether a certain statement should be given or not, then she even pointed out which one of them should be accepted, which one of them should not be.
Yes.
It was in detail that she guided me to make this compilation on materialism. For this purpose, I had read once again the whole of the Life Divine to make this compilation. There was one sentence which I had taken from the Life Divine to begin with the whole compilation.
Mm-hmm.
And the following sentence, Mother liked so much, it was from Sri Aurobindo. And she repeated this statement twice once I spoke. That sentence was, all life must be accepted, but all life must be transformed. When I uttered this sentence, Mother said, Tut Ela. And she repeated and she said, all life must be accepted, but all life must be transformed. And she repeated again, all life must be accepted, but all life must be transformed. I felt extremely happy when Mother spoke these words again. And then I thought that I will present to the youth in my compilation Sri Aurobindo's statements on the psychology of the human being, starting from the inconscient to the superconscient. And my idea was to read first of all on the inconscient, then the subconscient, and then the surface consciousness, and then the subliminal consciousness, and then the superconscient, and right up to the supermind. So, on one day I had taken all the statements on the inconscient, and I read them out. She approved all the quotations that I had put before her, but as it were to criticize me, or to put me on the right road, she said, "Is there nothing that Sri Aurobindo has written on the supermind?" And I was immediately corrected. And then I said, "Mother, he has written so much on the supermind." So Mother said, "Bring to me what Sri Aurobindo has said on the supermind." So from that time onward, I took to the Mother several quotations on the supermind. And all the quotations that I took to her, she approved all of them. And I felt that she was very happy with every statement on the supermind. There was one statement in the Life Divine which describes the Superman as distinguished from the Asura and Rakshasa. This is toward the end of the Life Divine. And when I read this whole passage, she said, "This is so important." And she said, "Can you give me a copy of this statement?" So I said, "Mother, I will bring tomorrow." So she said, "I want to send this to Yvonne." And she said that I will write a letter to Yvonne. And she wrote that letter in my presence to Yvonne, saying that I have here a statement on the supermind, and I thought it will interest you very much. And then Mother signed it with her blessings, and she put it in the envelope, and she said, "As soon as I get that statement from you, I will send it to Yvonne." And then the next day, in fact, early morning, Mother asked Champaklalji to take that statement from me in the early morning. And I had typed it out on the previous night. Mm-hmm. It was ready with me. I gave it to him. But I must say that all the quotations I had taken on the supermind, she was very happy with all of them. But my full compilation was never fully read out to the Mother. It remained only at that stage, still on the supermind. So that booklet has never come out. All that I had compiled for the youth. So that remains yet to be, one day to be yet to be wrote out. And even now I feel it is the most urgent work, and one has to bring out something for the youth of India.
Well, it was partly my motivation in preparing India's rebirth also. Because I tried to avoid anything that was too highly, not philosophical, because Swamina is never philosophical, but which is too much out of the reach of the normal Indian internet. So, and in fact, readers have been able, many readers tell us that for the first time they felt they could understand Swamina. Whereas if they take the Life Divine, or if they take even the synthesis, they are lost.
At one time I had the opportunity of editing a journal called Sri Aurobindo's Action for a few months. And during that period I had the privilege of asking the mother as to what I should put into the journal.
Mm-hmm.
So she said two or three things which are very important. She said, do not put anything that Sri Aurobindo has said before 1910. Because after coming to Pondicherry, Sri Aurobindo had completely changed. This was the first thing she told me. Secondly, she said that I should put the photograph of Sri Aurobindo in every issue on the first page. And she told me that it should be Sri Aurobindo, this picture which Satprem has put on his book, The Adventure of Consciousness. Yes. That is the picture that mother showed me, and she said you should put this picture. And then I had collected citations from Sri Aurobindo on the social and political life. And this I had collected mainly from the Life Divine, the Human Cycles, and the Ideal of Human Unity. And I had at one stage collected nearly 60 or 70 quotations. And to each one or each group of quotations, I had given my own headings. And I was very particular that mother approved of those headings which I had written, so that there is no distortion, and I wanted to be very scrupulous. So mother was very kind, and I read out to her all the headings that I had put, and also read out to her all the quotations that I had collected over a few days. And that has been published later on, the entire booklet. It is on the title of Social Change or something like that. But the entire booklet has been published. And the entire thing that I had collected, I had brought out in one single issue of Sri Aurobindo's action. It was an enlarged issue. And there was one very important remark she had made at that time.
Yes.
And after my having read the entire compilation, she said, you will give this little by little, no? So I said, mother, if I give little by little, there is a big difficulty. Because in Sri Aurobindo's writing, unless you see the whole, very often it may seem as if Sri Aurobindo is advocating the opponent's point of view. And unless one brings in other elements, the subsequent quotations and writings, the entire sense does not become very clear. So she said, yes, that is true. So I said, mother, I would like to put the entire compilation in one go, in one issue. So she approved of it. But my own feeling afterwards was that I made a mistake. My own feeling was that if you put this whole thing at one stroke, people do not read the whole thing. They don't have that patience to go through the whole thing. So I concluded that mother's remark that she had made of bringing out little by little had great wisdom. And although she approved of what my proposal to bring all at one issue, in one issue, I thought it was only a concession she made to my feeling. But today, for example, I fully see that it would have been much better if I had to bring out that compilation little by little. And in answer to the idea that I had, that unless you put totality, you cannot, you may do injustice to Sri Aurobindo's views. I feel personally that that is true, but then you have to select in such a way that within a short span you bring the totality.
Yes.
But to give the totality at one stroke in so many pages, I felt that that was not really wise. And I would like to say that what Mother had remarked in the beginning had really the wisdom. And if Mother permitted me to do according to my suggestion, it was only her concession to me. During that time, I had also the opportunity of presenting to the Mother certain specific problems in regard to India.
What problems?
These problems, first of all, for example, I put one question. Mother, what is the most important thing that we should do in India? So she said, the first thing that you ought to do is to change the constitution in such a way that only those people who combine honesty and capability should come to power. And she added that normally people who are honest are not capable and those who are capable are not honest. Therefore, she said, it is very important that people who combine these two, they should be able to enter into the seat of power. This was a very great revelation to me, and I felt that we should all work for the change in the constitution of India. In fact, I must tell you that for 25 years thereafter, I have been in search of those formulas by which the parliament and our constitution can be changed. And I am still on that work, actually. The other thing that I had asked the Mother was about education. And I had said that most important thing is to give a new aim to the educational system of India.
Yes.
So when I put this question as to what should be the aim of education, she said, give me a piece of paper and I shall write on it. And then she wrote the following words on that. She said, there is a divine reality wanting to be manifested. We aim at knowing this reality and working for its manifestation. In fact, this particular statement has helped me personally in my life very much, because later on when I was asked to be education advisor to the government of India, in my mind, in my heart, in my spirit, I was throughout guided by this statement of the Mother. There was also a question regarding the place of patriotism in our plan of action.
Yes.
In regard to India. And there was a conflict among some of us who were working together. And there was one view that we should have only internationalism as our aim, to be universal.
Yes.
And that when you are universal, then there is no place for patriotism. And in my own heart, while I appreciated very much the ideal of universality, I had felt that patriotism is not contrary to universality. And therefore, I had drafted particularly a statement so that I may have from the Mother herself directly a solution to this problem. And this is what I wrote. I read out to her, and she approved of that statement, in which I had tried to justify patriotism, which would not be contrary to internationalism. So if you like, I can read out to you what I drafted.
Yes.
I had written, when man grows in consciousness, he will live more by laws of unity and harmony than by preferences and conflict. Internationalism and human unity will then be possible. So also multi-citizenship and world government. The spirit of patriotism, as it is understood today, that is competition and domination, is wrong. But to love one's country and to work for the highest expression of one's country is true patriotism. It is fully justified and should always remain. I was very happy when Mother approved of it thoroughly, this statement. I had also put a question when Dalai Lama had come to the Mother.
Yes. This is recording.
It is recorded, but there is one question which is not there in the agenda. And it is given to some extent, but not in its fullness. Mm-hmm. She had been asked by Dalai Lama, and I was present at that time, India is very helpful to us who have come from Tibet. But in what way would India be even more helpful to us? So Mother had said that actually India should work for the federation of Tibet with India. And then she had told me that Sri Aurobindo had the vision of a great federation of Afghanistan, Nepal, Bhutan, Tibet, Burma, Ceylon and India.
Pakistan.
And Pakistan. So that all these countries would be united under one large federation. And this also has been very helpful to me in my work in India throughout my career in education ministry, because very often I had to go to UNESCO and speak of the principle of federation and unity of India and other countries which are neighboring and how they can collaborate, cooperate and so on. So this was another important insight that Mother had given. And then of course there are many other problems regarding religion. And
did Mother speak to you about religion?
About religion she had told me when I had written something on religion and I had presented that draft on religion. She added to the draft that religions and religious organizations will prove to be the greatest obstacle in our work. And it is true that I have found subsequently in all my work in the government of India that the greatest difficulty has come from this quarter. Whenever I wanted to bring about a change in the system of education on the lines of true spirituality, so that our children come to know of what may be called the true spiritual knowledge, then all the claims of religions, all the claims of exclusivism, all forms of fundamentalism, whether recognized or not, they all have come in full play and obstructed the smooth passage of that kind of education which would have really been very beneficial to the country and to the children, because children would have been able to see that exclusivism of religion can be transcended. and that one can be truly spiritual without being bound to any narrow exclusivism or claim.
Yes.
She had also told me about education for the country, and she had said that you should have two systems of education, not one system. One system of education which would be for those students who cannot study by themselves. And another system of education where students can learn by themselves. And this again helped me very much in future, in the subsequent years, because I always strove to create a condition in which, while the ordinary system need not be disturbed too much, I tried to create conditions in which the second system of education could be created. And much effort was put in to create that second system of education, and although it has taken no concrete shape, but many ideas have been put, have been afloat, and were put into the system, so that in due course, under favorable circumstances, this new system of education can come into existence. She had also told me one very important thing in the context of a question that was put by one of the teachers. What is mother's real view about the importance of French in India?
Mm-hmm.
And she told me, in answer to this question, she said, I may not be able to say this very clearly to people, but I am telling you, she says, that the English that has come to India through the Britishers has brought with it a great dose of commercialism.
Hmm. Yes.
And this has been injurious to the spirit of India.
Hmm.
This commercialism is not the genius of India. Therefore, she said that I always felt that there should be another foreign language which would counteract against the commercialism of the British. And she added that among the other foreign languages, French is the language which has great qualities, which is aristocracy of the intellect and purity and clarity and precision, that it can successfully counteract against the commercialism that is brought in by Britishers through English. So she said, I do not know if you can realize this aim, but this is my view about it, she says. In fact, after receiving this answer from the mother, I myself felt inspired very much to study French. And whatever little French I have studied thereafter is because of this great message that mother gave me. And in fact, in subsequent years, I have really been convinced by what mother has said. And very often when people have asked me this question, I always told them that there is a great weakness in the present Indian mind, namely to be influenced by the foreign.
Yes.
English is a foreign language which has this great demerit of commercialism. Therefore, if India has to revive back again to the purity of its genius, then another foreign language has to be used. And therefore, I am completely convinced that without bringing French into India in a very large way and putting French along with English, we will not be able to regain our true genius. And I also felt, and this helped me very much when I was working at the UNESCO, where I found that French is one of the 6 official languages of UNESCO. Mm. And I found how much useful it would be for Indian students to study French.
Yes.
And even from a purely utilitarian point of view, it would be extremely useful if Indians studied French quite well. And I also understood, because then I came into contact with France quite a lot, and I really understood that when we study French, the qualities of purity of the mind, clarity of the mind, precision of expression, these are really the hallmarks of French culture.
Yes.
Whatever may be the present condition of French culture, yes, or European culture as a whole, but this matter becomes extremely clear, because I really realized that to the French, the terminal point of thought is clarity. To the British, the terminal point of thought is commercial gain. If you can show to the British it pays, it is the final argument. To the French, when you say it is clear, it is the final argument. And then I could see that the Indian genius, which is spiritual, is much more harmonious with what French spirit represents through its clarity and purity. And therefore I understood why Mother spoke of the need for French to be given to the Indian students. But this is my experience thereafter, and today I am convinced about it.
Saying that the Indian students, I may not remember very precisely, but this should be taught a form of simplified Sanskrit. Do you have something?
But this also she has told me.
She said, she spoke of, if I remember well, a formula of 3 languages consisting of one a foreign language. She didn't, in that instance, she didn't specify all that you have just said. 2, the mother tongue, and 3, a form of simplified Sanskrit. Can you tell me more?
Well, this is what she said when this question had arisen about languages.
Mm.
She had told me, if you have to teach only one language to the students,
yes,
it should be international language.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Secondly, she said that for general development of students, you should teach several languages. And she said the best way of teaching languages would be to have a kind of a comparative table in which you say that this word in this language has this meaning, in this language has this meaning, or equivalent to this word in this language, this is the word, in another language, this is the word, in another language, this is the word. So that 5-6 languages children can learn very well. In regard to Sanskrit,
yes,
she said that it should be the real official language of the country.
I see.
And she said that it is only Sanskrit which will be ultimately acceptable to the people of India.
She said that.
She said that Sanskrit is the only language which creates equal handicap for all the parts of the country.
Equal handicap?
Yes. So that nobody has a special advantage over the others by adopting this language or that language. If Sanskrit is accepted, everyone will have the equal handicap to learn it. so that nobody will have a natural advantage over the others, and therefore nobody will have a complaint against it. Then she added also that when I speak of Sanskrit, it should be simple Sanskrit,
yes,
but not simplified.
I see.
She made a distinction between the two.
I see.
What she said that it should be simple Sanskrit, but not simplified. She did not specify how to distinguish between the two.
No, I understand. Makes sense.
But she said that only Sri Aurobindo could have given that language, because Sri Aurobindo had written. But I do not know where, she said, I do not know where it is now, where it is. And then she referred to our colleague, Jagannathji. Mm-hmm. And mother said that perhaps he can write something that is relevant to this. On this subject again, I have myself given a lot of thought.
Yes.
And I find that there are three or four elements in Sanskrit which can be thought of as simplified,
yes,
and which should be distinguished from simple.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there is a proposal that you should omit the dual in Sanskrit language. Now, this will simplify this language very much. But I personally feel that there will be real simplification, but not making it simple.
It will be a loss.
It will be a loss. Mm. Then there are, in this Sanskrit language, there are many optional forms.
Yes.
Which is only a matter of richness. Now, omitting all of them will be a loss.
Yes.
And it will simplify, but it will not make the language simple. On the other hand, there is a lot of difficulty in learning Sanskrit language because of sandhi.
Yes.
Liaison. Now, if you can remove sandhi, I think the language can become quite simple. Very easy to understand. And it does not do any harm to the language itself.
I see. Sri Aurobindo complained a lot,
yes,
about, I do not know Sanskrit, so I can't say, but he complains a lot about increasingly complex compounds, compounded words. Because of course Sanskrit, like in fact all Indian languages, has that capacity to club words together. But he says that at a certain stage of Sanskrit, of classical Sanskrit, it reached an exaggerated point where compounds were,
That is true actually, both in the Foundations of Indian Culture and elsewhere. Sri Aurobindo has written this and said that actually Sanskrit language itself was replaced by many other new languages of India.
Yes.
Because of the fact that Sanskrit began to become very ornamental.
Yes.
It became full of compounds. And there was tremendous emphasis upon complexity of structure and construction. And that is very true. Even in Kalidasa, we find this ornamental value very much attached to the very composition of Sanskrit poems and verses and so on. But when we come to Bana, for example, he wrote the great story of Kadambari, where there is one sentence which is 120 lines. So you can imagine how much this Sanskrit language had a great capacity, no doubt, as you rightly say. Competed with each other in making it so ornamental and so full of compounds,
so it became overburdened.
That it really became very overburdened. And
I am told, for instance, that the Gita is of a very simple Sanskrit, basically.
Very true. In fact, the Gita is a language of Vyasa.
Huh.
And the whole of Mahabharata has this great merit.
Yes.
It is simple,
terse,
serious, simple, and moves very smoothly.
So in fact, for instance, if students were to be taught Sanskrit, they could be taught the Gita simply to...
Yes, that is a good example. Actually,
a way to teach them simple Sanskrit.
Well, I am told that Sri Aurobindo used to give to many beginners Nalanchana from Mahabharata. The story of Nala. The Nala and the Mayanti. Because that is also a Sanskrit which is very simple and which can be understood very easily. Actually, for learning Sanskrit, we have to create new types of books. And for each province, you should have a special book.
Yes.
Take, for example, Gujarati, which I know very well because it is my mother tongue. I would like to write, if I have time, a book in which I would give all the words which are in Gujarati, the same as Sanskrit words. So that Gujarati students know that half the vocabulary is already known to them.
In fact, Indian students should not learn Sanskrit through English. That would be a big mistake.
Yes.
They should learn Sanskrit through their mother tongue.
Through their mother tongue or directly through the Sanskrit?
With
the help of their mother tongue.
Yes. Yes, that's what I mean.
Yes. That's quite true. But because in every province, as I said,
yes.
You should have a book in which you have the list of all the words which are the same as in Sanskrit. So the student has first of all a great encouragement because he will see that at least for 50% or 60% or 70%, even 80%, their words in their own mother tongue are the same as in Sanskrit.
Even in terms of grammar,
yes,
Indian languages have a lot in common. The grammar has a lot in common with Sanskrit.
Yes, quite a lot.
To varying degrees.
But quite a lot.
Even Tamil, which is supposed to be a Dravidian language.
Yes.
I have a friend here in Kunur, who is a Brahmin from Tanjavur, and he has a thorough knowledge of literary Tamil and of Sanskrit. He's a disciple of the late Paramacharya. And he told me, even though Tamil is supposed to be a highly grammatical language, he told me there is no such thing as Tamil grammar. It is all Sanskrit grammar.
Oh, really? Oh, I see. So that's why it is the one language which has to be studied by everybody. I think, actually, Mother said, when India will discover her soul, Sanskrit will naturally become India's national language and official language.
I see. She said this to you?
This also to me, she said. Yes.
It's very important.
It's a very important statement. When India comes back to her soul, then Sanskrit will automatically, naturally become its national and official language. And therefore she said that in our school, she wanted that all children had to be taught Sanskrit.
Yes.
And we started with that. And when Auroville was established, Mother put down Sanskrit as one of the languages to be learned by everybody, whether he was Indian or foreigner.
Yes.
So that is the great importance Mother has laid upon Sanskrit.
It's interesting.
And it is very, very important. Yes.
Now coming to the mother tongues.
Yes.
Sri Aurobindo said many times, and even as late as 1920, if I remember well, when he wrote about national education, he insisted that for an Indian child to learn in English led to his mental capacities to be automatically distorted. And he wrote many times during his revolutionary days, but also after, and then as 1920, maybe even later, I don't know. He wrote many times that an Indian student, of course, could learn English, but should follow his studies in his mother tongue. And that it was extremely important so that his mental makeup would not be distorted. Otherwise, learning through English, which is not a natural medium for him, would automatically lead to a great impoverishment of his mind, mental capacities.
And on this question also I had put down three sentences for Mother's approval, and she approved the following three sentences.
Please.
First sentence was, the mother tongue should be the medium of instruction. Second one was, simple Sanskrit should be the national language. And third, English should be the international language for the time being.
Yes, that makes sense.
And Mother approved of all the three statements. But I have given a lot of thought on this subject later on. And although it is not relevant to your asking questions to me, I would like to say the following. That the word mother tongue is to be rightly understood. I have many friends in Delhi and I ask the question, what is your mother tongue? And of course the answer is Hindi, because most of the children belong to Delhi originally and their parents have Hindi language as their mother tongue. But when you really probe further, you find that many mothers speak to their children in English. So if I ask a child very honestly, what is your mother tongue? And the language that the child has understood from his mother or his mother or her mother is English and Hindi both. So my question very often is that as we make a transition from the present day to the future, our concept of mother tongue has to change. And while it is true that mother tongue is the most important instrument of education, it need not necessarily be that everyone should have only one mother tongue.
No.
If the world is going to be multilingual, as it is going to be, whether we like it or not, this is true not only of India but also of France, where many parents will speak English along with French. It will happen in England, where apart from English, many languages in England, for example, today, children of Indian families have English and one of the Indian languages as mother tongues.
Yes.
So many Indian children in England have got two or three mother tongues.
Yes.
And so in case of America, where also people from all the world have come there. So what is the mother tongue of a child? The languages in which the mother speaks, the languages through which the mother is putting the ideas into the tender brain of the child. This, to my mind, is the definition of mother tongue.
Yes.
Therefore, the formula is correct, that the mother tongue should be the natural medium of instruction. But in case the mother has got two or three languages in which she has been communicating to the child, then I would say that the child has two or three mother tongues. And therefore, in the system of education, this should be given its recognition and utilization.
Yes, a choice.
Not only a choice.
A freedom of choice.
Not only freedom of choice, but it will mean that a child should have multilingual instruction.
Yes, yes.
Because then the child has a natural capacity for several languages at the same time.
Yes.
Therefore.
Well, in fact, in any case, several languages must be taught.
But true, but.
I still feel that today in India, even today, the vast majority of children, what you say, the phenomenon you describe, might be in the upper classes of society or maybe in the urban classes of society. But if I look, for instance, here in Tamil Nadu, even with Tamilians who know very well English, the mother will speak Tamil. She will not speak English to the child. Except if the family is Christian or Anglo-Indian, or both. I know some Anglo-Indians in Kotagiri, they know only English and nothing else. They hardly know any Tamil, you see. Even though they are from, racially speaking, if the word has any meaning, the roots are Tamil, but they don't know Tamil. Or really, just a few words for day to day use. So then their mother tongue is English and nothing else. But in the vast majority, if you go, except perhaps the big cities, if you go to the smaller towns.
But big cities means not like only like Delhi or Calcutta, but even small cities today like Surat.
Yes, I was thinking.
Ahmedabad.
Yes. What will you have?
Jamnagar.
Yes.
Parents speak to them in English and mother tongue. Yes. Yes. There are several families whom I know.
This is a fairly recent phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon which has to be reckoned.
No, I understand. I agree.
Take for example, Z channel of television. If you listen to the newscast, they use so many English words now. That you might say that even Hindi itself is changed, which is a great pity. To my mind, the children should be taught to speak each language in the chaste language.
Yes.
And when he speaks one language, he should not mix it up with some other language.
No.
This should be the norm, and one should insist upon it, and a national character is built by this kind of chastity. But instead of that, what is happening today is a terrible hodgepodge.
Yes, absolutely. Even in France, there are lots of English words coming in. Yes. Some principal are protesting.
Yes.
Saying that we should be on our guard and we should not let.
But in India, there is no such movement at all. I find surprising that people have taken up this Z channel very easily. And in fact, some of them prefer it because there is so much of mixture of English. And now if this is in the on the Z channel, you can imagine how many people must be listening to it. It's not only upper class or only a few elite. It's a large number of families today speak this language. In fact, there is a great weakness in India. And this was present even when I was a boy, that is to say when I was 10 years old. And my own mother used to feel proud when she could use, while speaking Gujarati, some words of English.
Yes, I know this phenomenon.
This phenomenon is widespread in India, that if you could speak some words even in your own mother tongue, you can, of a foreign language, English particularly, you used to feel that you are very modern, very progressive, very fashionable. And this has increased now.
Yes, very much.
So even the ordinary families, not necessarily of elite category, but ordinary families, this phenomenon is increasing quite a lot.
That is also a result of the poor level of education for the past
years. Also because of the fact that we have not been able to cultivate our own mother tongue.
Yes, exactly.
As fully as we ought to.
Exactly.
There are many words, for example, I point out to my friends in Delhi, give me an equivalent of this particular word. And they have to scratch their head for quite some time before they can answer me. That means that the words don't come readily to them. I have often asked the question, give me a Hindi word which would express exactly by the word scarcely, rarely. And they are not able to give me the word. If I say, rarely it happens. They give some words, but they do not exactly correspond with the word rarely. In Gujarati, we have a word, exactly the word for rarely in Gujarati. But in Hindi, I have asked many people, they have a word for rare individuals. But if I say this rarely happens, they don't have exact word for it. They have a word which says, it does not happen often. Or it happens lesser times.
These things, of course, well, language...
There are, but you know, when you want to make your language chaste, you should have readily... These words must come to your mind very readily.
Yes, of course, but you see, each language of India has its own genius, as we know, and yes, has developed its own literature. But again, since independence, the government has very little to encourage the growth of regional literatures and to really help genuine good writers. Good writers have always made their names by themselves, never with the help of the government, or only once they had already become known. So here also the government is responsible, because the regional languages have been neglected, with the exception possibly of Hindi.
You know, the point is that the government did something and they have tried to develop the languages, but they have not underlined a very important principle that languages are never imposed officially in any country. If you want to develop a language, you should encourage people, and that encouragement has to be given not through government machinery.
No.
But by various other non-governmental machineries, by general encouragement, and this particular aspect has been neglected thoroughly, so that there is no movement in India to protect the chastity of any language. All the languages today in India, after the independence, have become transitional languages, which is very, within 50 years, all the languages of India have become transitional languages. There's so much of mixture of English with our native languages, that everywhere you find this phenomenon.
Once the cultural life of a state is really intense, once there is an intensive cultural life, something which is really alive, that an identity which people relate to, then the literature naturally follows.
Quite true.
And then the language is naturally aligned.
Quite true.
But if that cultural life is not encouraged, not nurtured like a delicate plant,
yes,
then it tends to just dry up.
No, you have always in your country some very good writers, good authors, who themselves love the chastity of the language so well, and these people have to be encouraged.
Yes.
I have, for example, before me, the example of Professor Higgins in Bernard Shaw's story, which has been made into a very big film, My Fair Lady, where Professor Higgins is the hero, and he has mastered the English language so well that by listening to anybody speaking English, he would be able to say from which quarter of Great Britain a person hails. And in fact, the whole story starts with this, and he was so particular that everyone should speak chaste English. And the whole theme, you might say, of the whole film is this chastity of the language. And he teaches one girl who was selling flowers, and this is a challenge he has taken upon himself, that within a few months, 6 months, he said, I will teach her English language proper so that she can stand among the royal families of the world speaking in English. And he did it. So anyway, there should be an encouragement of this kind, that there are some great authors and great linguists who really want their languages to be chaste and to remain chaste. And they should be encouraged.
Yes,
but there is no encouragement of this kind at all. There should be a real recognition of such people.
Usually they are recognized once they are dead.
Yes, which is too late.
With the exception of great geniuses like Tagore.
Yes.
But you see a single man like Tagore.
Yes.
What he did with Bengali.
Yes.
And how he really set
free. Yes, therefore in Bengal. Yes, in Bengal you really find that even in the elite, people speak Bengali in a chaste manner. Which is a tremendous tribute to the people of Bengal and tribute to some of the writers like Tagore and some others. So that is a very great example.
Anyway, so Kirita, I think unless you remember something else very in a striking way, we have covered quite a few things. Of course, politics we have not discussed much, because that would have been probably too much linked to the events of the time. And in any case, we have all of Mother's messages where she spoke about what India stands for and what she must work for and what she must represent in the world. And so all this.
There is one story,
yes,
regarding Bangladesh. And perhaps you may feel interested to know this following story. In the month of March or April 1971, Mother had given in writing a message for Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And she had written, recognition of Bangladesh is imperative and urgent. This message was transmitted to Mrs. Indira Gandhi. But apparently nothing had happened thereafter. In the month of June, I had gone to Delhi. And you know, Mrs. Nandini Satpathy was intermediary between the mother and Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And she herself was feeling that nothing was happening on that front. And then I told her, I said that this was rather unfortunate. And then I spoke to her also about the message that Sri Aurobindo had given on 15th of August 1947, where Sri Aurobindo had spoken of the necessity of uniting India and Pakistan. So she felt that I should be able to speak to Indiraji directly. So she requested her husband to take me to Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And we both went to Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And when I met her, so June 1971, and then I gave her a copy of the message of Sri Aurobindo, 15th of August 1947. And she read that message and she said, yes, I know, but this will take a long time. So I said, no, it need not take a long time. It can happen any time. And then I said about Bangladesh. I said, Mother has given you the message about Bangladesh. And she became quite ruffled. And she said, what do you know about Bangladesh? She said, I said, I know nothing about Bangladesh. But I know that the Mother has given a message. So I have only a spiritual feeling about it. But she said, you know, I have people whose families are in Bangladesh and they are all suffering. And you all people take up responsibilities without knowing what is in the Bangladesh. So I said, no, I am only speaking to you as a brother would speak to his sister on this subject. So she said, come with me. And she took me into another room. And then she said, I do not know how to communicate with the mother. There are people who come to me and speak to me in the name of the mother. And nobody explains to the mother my difficulty. So I said, if you want to tell me, I will tell the mother. So she said, my difficulty is that not a single member of parliament is agreeable to the recognition of Bangladesh. Not even Jay Prakash Narayan. In that condition, how can I function? And people go and tell the mother and she hears people's whatever people tell her. So I said, it is not true. Mother has told me that she listens only to what the divine tells her and to nobody else. So do not be worried on that account. So she smiled. And then she said, but you know, mother is not well nowadays. She's sick. So I said, that is also wrong. Mother herself has said that she is not sick. That she is undergoing a process of physical transformation. And all that is seen outwardly is a consequence of the process of physical transformation. She is not sick at all. So she again felt happy. And she said, my only difficulty is that there is nobody to support. When I went back, I told Pavitrada, I told this to,
Pavitra was
not there, I spoke this to Andreda, and I told him that this is what my conversation with Indiraji was. And he communicated all this to the mother. Then I don't know what happened, but there was a change in the situation thereafter. And as we all know, in December, action did take place.
Yes.
And to prepare for this action, we also know that she went round different countries of the world and produced an argument that what is happening in Bangladesh is not an internal affair of Pakistan. But it is a question of genocide, which is a universal issue.
Yes.
I think she got this argument very well conveyed to people, and she got help or support from many, many nations of the world. And then this action took place. And then Mrs. Indira Gandhi wrote a letter to the mother soon after the Bangladesh war was over, in which she said, and this whole letter is reproduced in the agenda,
yes,
volume number 12.
Yes.
The entire letter of Indira Ji is there, and mother's answer also is there.
Yes.
So this was one political event, and of which I know personally, and it was very important event, because this is regarded as the golden hour of Indira Gandhi, this particular event.
Yes.
So it was such an important thing, and it is the mother who really helped her. There is another thing which I had heard, and it was a letter from Mrs. Indira Gandhi to the mother, in which she had written to ask whether India should produce nuclear bomb or not. And although I have not read the letter, but Pavitrata had shown that letter to me. And on the text of the first page of the letter, her mother had herself written an answer in big hand, N-O. And then Pavitrata had told me that mother had said that India is the only country which is a balance between two camps of the countries of the world. And therefore, it has a unique position which can keep the world in peace. If India also produces a nuclear bomb, this balance will be lost.
Well, that was the argument.
This is what Pavitrata told me, that mother had said to Pavitrata.
I always felt it must have had occult reasons. Occult, I mean, inner reasons.
Yes.
Because the fact of developing nuclear weapons attracts certain concept.
And also the desire to utilize it.
Yes, yes, yes.
And utilization of the nuclear weapons, or even the intention to utilize it, is suicidal to humanity, actually. Anyway, this is what Pavitrata told me.
Yes,
in answer to
us.
When, similarly, when in 1967, when Uthant had made a statement,
yes,
that even a man in the street knows that the world has resources enough to feed all the people of the world. If this is not happening, it is because the people are divided into blocks. And therefore, he said that the only solution is a change of consciousness. And if this is understood, then change of consciousness is the most important thing to be worked for.
Yes.
Something to this effect.
Yes, it is there. Mother quotes.
The mother quotes. And then this was shown by Pavitrata to the mother. And mother was very pleased to read this. And then mother had written a letter to Uthant. And in which mother had said, appreciating what he had said. And also said that she had said that she was sending to him a copy of The Ideal of Human Unity. So this was another event which I remember, which was quite interesting for me, because this was a very important message of Uthant, and he was Secretary General. And then Uthant had written a reply to that letter, in which he had thanked the mother for the message, and he had said that he is aware of Sri Aurobindo's writings. Yes. And he had appreciated very much that the mother had sent a letter to him. This is what Pavitrata had told me. And There was another incident of which I am quite aware, and that is that somebody reported to the mother that Mrs. Indira Gandhi has become a communist. So mother said, "This is not true at all. She is not a communist." And she said, "You give me a pen and paper, I want to write." I don't remember exactly what she wrote, but what I can recollect is that she said, "Indira Gandhi is not a communist. People ought to know that I stand behind her." But it is true that rich people have put their faith in the wealth rather than in the divine. Therefore, in the irresistible march of time, they will be crushed.
Yes, I think the second part of this
thing is there in the agenda, perhaps.
Yes,
this is what she had written.
Can I borrow this? Because I had never realized that it was written by you. In fact, I had looked at it.
It is not Sri Aurobindo's language at all.
No, I knew. But since there is absolutely no indication as to who prepared it.
No, I think there was a mistake in printing, because you know, when I had given, I had written this.
Uh-huh.
You can see the preface, what is written there.
No,
there is some.
Preface: the country and the world are passing through a great crisis. Sri Aurobindo had foreseen this and gave solutions to the problems which confront us today. Some of these problems and the solutions in the light of Sri Aurobindo are including this.
That's right.
In the light of.
That's right. Correct.
Yes, it is, but still it is not too explicit.
So you know, because.
I understand. I'll go through it again. There is much material. In fact, there's plenty of material.
It's quite
beginning with the author King. There's plenty of material.
Yes, quite a lot.
Even at the time of the Second World War, we have all the messages of India and how India was previously protected from Assyrian forces, but no longer so. The message which Mother herself gave on India's independence.
Oh yes.
It's 47, you see that right now. And there are so many messages which are scattered here and there, and I want to bring all this.
That will be wonderful. Together.
Plus a few things from the agenda. Not everything, because some things are better left in the course of the agenda.
Yes, so the context is known.
Yes. But wherever she speaks of this, where she expressed that intense need for change in India, and the fact that India is wallowing in the mud, that has to be the sense. The people are really saying, even them. Today we can understand that India is wallowing in the mud.
Yeah.
But from Mother to say that in 62 or
63. Yeah, absolutely. There was also an interview. One Mr. Raman was the editor of Illustrated Weekly of India.
Yes. Oh yes.
He had put some questions to the mother.
Yes, the question.
And then there was one important question: are you satisfied with the progress of India? And mother said, not at all. Or it was very unsatisfactory, she had said.
Yes, the whole question.
So even at that time, that was a very big question, and many people had felt. Because people were feeling that the world country was moving so fast, and there was so much of
might
progress.
Might have been moving fast, but back
home. But now when we read that mother herself, it was unsatisfactory, we can now appreciate it better. That it was really unsatisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
One is now convinced that it was really unsatisfactory. If now it is unsatisfactory, what to talk of 1967?
Exactly. So that is all interesting.
There was also a small anecdote. One deputy secretary of the Ministry of Education had come to visit our center of education and the ashram.
Yes.
And he had put some questions during that time when he was there. And one question he had asked was, what is the research work which is being done in the ashram? So Mother had said, read Sri Aurobindo's books. The second question that he had asked was, how do you measure the progress that one makes in research in yoga? So Mother had said, the extent to which an individual can remain perfectly equal in any circumstance will give you the measure of the research in yoga that that person is doing. The next day this gentleman was to leave Pondicherry in the early morning. And I was near the ashram gates and was about to see off this gentleman when suddenly somebody came looking for me and said that Mother has a message to give to this man. She has just written and it has to be given to this man. So I got that message of the Mother and I delivered it to that man. And this message was as follows. One question has to be asked of the government of India. Does it want to work for the future or does it want to remain obstinately clung to the past? And this man, of course, when he took the message, he showed a great respect for the message. And later on, when I saw that report that he had written, I found that this message written by the Mother in her own hand, he had put on the very first page of his report, which he had given to the government of India.
Absolutely, which is very interesting, because the message is published.
It is
in the agenda.
Yes.
But the context is
context not is not known, but this is the context.
Yes, that's very important.
There is one humorous anecdote. There was one minister in the Department of Education who had come to Pondicherry. And he had asked for the darshan of the Mother. And he was taken to the Mother. And instead of looking at the Mother, he looked through the window and said, what a beautiful scene of the sea. And then hurriedly he came and went away. Then Mother made a humorous remark that if he had to speak these words in French, it would have made a better meaning.
What a beautiful
view of the sea. Quelle belle vue de la mer.
Actually, you showed such disrespect.
Not this is such a negligent man.
But this is disrespect, I mean,
yeah, it means to. Yeah, but this is what he did in the presence of the Mother.
Very cool. And he was the Minister of
Education.
The central government.
Yeah.
He should have begun with educating himself to start with.
His name, I will give you, but only for you.
Yes.
His name is Bhakta Darshan.
No.
He was the Minister of Education. Not the cabinet rank, but he was a minister in the Ministry of Education. But you can see the consciousness of this man who came to meet the Mother.
You hardly looked at her.
He only looked at the sea and made this remark, that's all. So there is a social call where he had to say, "Weather, what a fine weather." How beautiful scenery all around.
You get to visit a family book, who?
So, spend some years in school.